It's the House State Affairs Committee meeting, February 16th, 2004. President Representative Lynn, Representative Holm, Representative Seaton, and Chair Representative Wyrock. Sorry I'm late. Budget closeout. We're going to take up the Commission on Aging bill today, and it's my intent to move that out of committee today. But we had a number of questions that the committee had raised. Let's see, who's coming back before us? Someone with the commission?
No, Allison.
Mr. Ashman, you're online. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I am.
Okay. Hi.
Hi.
All right. We have also a number of people to sign in. Why don't, Ms. Baker, you start first and give us your name record, or for the record. Go ahead.
Laura.
And also for the record, Representative Gruenberger has joined us. And Representative Coghill. Thank you, Ms. Baker.
Laura Baker with the Department of Health and Social Services, Administrative Services Division. I understand there were some questions on the fiscal note from the last committee meeting. And I can either answer the questions or just give an explanation as to some of the difference in numbers that were reflected on the earlier note that the committee received.
We have before us a fiscal note dated 2/12/2004. Yeah, why don't you just review it for us, Ms. Baker?
Okay. Just to kind of go back, the earlier one that you folks had received had reflected an imbalance between the expenditures and the fund sources, and that was a technical glitch in our fiscal note system that we used in-house. The fiscal note you have from 2/12 should reflect the operating expenditures and funding of a total of 351.7, which is reflective of what's in the governor's FY 2005 budget proposal. The fiscal note is not an additional cost. It's just reflecting the cost associated with a commission if it's extended.
All right, thank you, Ms. Baker. Any questions on that for the committee? You can be here just in case anything else comes up on this bill.
Yeah, I'll be.
Also, the Alaska, in our packets today, pages 1 through 4 of the commission's plan has been provided. I know the committee last week had raised questions about the plan. And the plan, I looked at the whole thing. It's quite extensive and voluminous. I just provided for your benefit the summary, and you're welcome to ask the agency for the rest of that. I just wanted to see what it looked like. I also should note for the record that after the committee meeting last week, I did call the Health Senior Service line and got a recording and got an immediate call back from a woman who was a no-nonsense type of person. She didn't want to truck anything from me. She just wanted to know what I wanted. And so I actually appreciated that. So I said, sorry about you. Mr. Ashman?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
If you could identify yourself for the record again, please.
Yes, thank you. My name is Steve Ashman. I'm the director of the Division of Senior and Disability Services.
Okay. Did you have any further follow-up testimony, Mr. Ashman?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Church. I apologize. I wasn't able to attend the meeting that you had previously on this bill, but it was my understanding that one of the issues that was raised during that hearing was an item identified in the fiscal note that indicates that if the Commission on Aging is not extended, that the state of Alaska stands to lose $13 million in federal funding. Under the U.S. Code, the Older American Act, the state of Alaska is required to establish an advisory council. The Commission on Aging, of course, meets that requirement, and what they're required to do is develop and administrate an area plan, conduct public hearings, represent the interests of the older persons, and review and comment on community policies, programs, and actions that affect Alaskans. If we don't have that advisory commission or the Commission on Aging, we would be in jeopardy of losing those funds.
Thank you, Mr. Ashman. Any questions of the committee, Mr. Ashman? Thank you. Mr. Representative Holm, the sponsor of the bill, has also pointed out that last week we had Mr. Benarcy Lal testify telephonically. Are you present here, Mr. Well, why don't you come forward and identify yourself, please? Come forward.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, if you want to identify yourself for the record.
I just wanted to
say your name and who you represent.
My name is Banar Silala. I'm from Fairbanks, and I serve on the Alaska Commission on Aging, and I'm the current chair.
Thank you.
Last time, at the time of the first hearing, a question was asked if we could get some clarification about the need for a commission in order to receive federal dollars. And I think you have received a copy of a letter from Dr. Kawabori. You know, he's the administrator in the Region 10 office and that supports that need. There are also some questions about the fiscal note, Mr. Chairman, and I think that those have been clarified. The comment was that because of some problems with the computation, I think it looked like we were making a profit, we certainly don't. If you look at the budget and compare it with the figures for year 2004, you will see that there's a substantial reduction in the amount, about $56,000. So that's all I have to say.
Mr. Lal, are there other members of the commission present today?
Not to my knowledge, but they should be arriving sometimes today. We are planning a three-day meeting in town and in order to do the hiring for the executive director.
And where are you going to meet?
We will be meeting at the Prospector, sir.
Well, I thank you for your service. I know that it's a sacrifice and it is a service, and I really appreciate it. Traveling here and also serving on the commission.
Thank you, sir. I do appreciate that, and I want to assure you that all the members that are serving on the commission, they're very dedicated people, and they do represent a wide spectrum of the society, and they're all senior citizens, so they certainly have a ground-level view of, you know, what's confronting the senior population. And I think it's important for you to keep in mind, you know, that as we progress, you know, our population is certainly going to double, you know, by year 2010, and by 2025, it'll be about 25% higher. So it'll triple. So, you know, it's a larger, you know, growth in senior population. And I think considering the contributions of most seniors to the state of Alaska, I think it makes sense, you know, that they will be provided with services so they can live with dignity and grace, you know, in settings that are closest to their homes and in the communities that they live.
We're joined by Representative Berkowitz, and Representative Lynn had a question. Representative Lynn.
Well, I'm sorry, I thought Representative Berkowitz is going first. I also would like to thank you for your service on the Aging Commission. Undoubtedly, the disclosing that I'm probably the oldest person on this committee. Your service is very much appreciated. But I did have a question. In addition to your other activities, has any proposed legislation, either this session or last session, involving seniors ever come before your commission for advice or counsel or what should or should not be done? Has any advice been requested by members of the legislature or by the administration on what which way to go on various issues involving seniors?
We have, through the chair, you know, Representative Lynn, we have supported the governor's senior care program most recently, and we have passed a resolution in support of that, and we have forwarded copies of those, and that's just the most recent example. In the past, we have been asked to provide support for various pieces of legislation affecting citizens, including, you know, the setting of the advisory boards for pioneers' homes and for veterans. We did that, and so we have been very active in supporting that. And in the audience, you know, Marie Darling is here. Now she's with the Capital City Task Force. She could probably list a whole bunch of legislation that not only the AARP supports, but we have been asked to support. We have lent support from time to time.
That's good, if I may.
Sure.
That's good. But, I mean, has anybody come to you before legislation is introduced for advice? Should it be introduced, or And if so, how should it be worded? What should be the content?
I believe on several occasions, I can recall in the last 4 or 5 years, you know, they have, and one of them that that I can think of that has undergone several modifications, the one that talks about the quality of life for senior citizens as they are, you know, in the later stages of their life and pretty close to dying. I think that's one of the, I can't remember the title of that bill, but we had quite a few discussions on that. That's just one example that comes to my mind.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lynn, Representative Grunberg, and then Representative Holm.
Hi. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry, I may have missed something. If I ask a question you've already answered, please bear with me. Question. I take it that your members are not confirmed by the legislature. Is that correct?
That's my understanding. Maybe Mr. Ashman can clarify that.
Second question. I see that in AS 4745-200 subsection C, it prohibits members from serving more than two consecutive terms or eight consecutive years, whichever is longer. Are you aware of why there should why you should have term limits? Is there any reason for that?
No, I think, you know, 7 years or 8 years of public service is certainly reasonable, and I think it gives the opportunity to other folks to come online. So, you know, I have no problems with that.
And finally, it says in AS 4745-200-A2 that one of the duties of the commission is to make recommendations to the legislature with respect to legislation, regulations, and appropriations for programs or services that benefit older Alaskans. And since you're here, we're here, is there anything you'd like to recommend?
Yes, sir, we do. And we're very supportive of that, and we have done that in the past and continue to do so.
So is there anything you'd like to recommend to us today?
We are supporting the governor's senior care program. Certainly it will come up for your review. And so if it does, you know, we certainly support that.
Thank you. Thank you,
Mr. Thank you, Mr. Long. Representative Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Lowell, thanks again for being here this morning. I just, in the process, I don't know if you're aware, but I imagine you probably are. We do have a Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, which provides for us a division an audit. And in the audit on page 16, and I'll just refer you to this because I want to charge you with something, and that is that on the bottom of page 16, they talk about the fact that there's been a number of cases where the backup has not been sent to the audit committee. And I'd like to have you, in your charge, look for that to make sure that we get the appropriate supporting backup so that the federal funding is commensurate with what it should be. It appears here that it was not, the evidence was not showing the reimbursements were really accurate, and I'd like to have you look at that.
Through the chair, Representative Holm, certainly the commission until last year was in the grant-making role, and we certainly were charged with doing that. But the Department of Administration was the one that was providing support to the commission for not only generating those kinds of reports, but also timely submission of those reports to the federal government. But certainly, and we'll keep that in mind, and I'll make sure that I'll convey this to Mr. Ashman and also to the Deputy Commissioner, you know, so that if there is any concern about that, that will be addressed on a timely basis.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Anything else? No. Thanks, Mr. Lowell. Any further questions, Mr. Lowell? Representative Dean? Nothing. Thanks, Mr. Lowell.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Trivett, as long as you're here, do you have anything you wanted to testify on?
Mr. Chairman, just very briefly, just to say that I'm Sam Trivett, retired public employees of Alaska, and we do support the continuation of this commission. We think it is very important. Obviously, as the audit report pointed out, some administrative issues that need to be worked on, but I think the commissioners are very dedicated. I've attended many of their meetings the last 2 or 3 years, and I think they do an excellent job, and they are concerned about what's going on. And I think probably I would like to see them have a stronger voice before you, personally.
Mr. Tribbett, do you get their newsletter or any informational information from the commission?
Yes, I do. Yes, and I do attend their meetings on a pretty regular basis.
Is it easy to follow?
Sometimes, yeah. Sometimes. I think with the changeover, there's been a lot of people not really sure who's doing what, and with a changeover and the whole department moving senior services around, I think that's probably caused some confusion, too. But part of that may be worked out once things get settled again, too.
Okay. So if you would want to provide information on how to better facilitate information coming out of the commission that benefits seniors and aging population of Alaska, is there a forum readily available for you to do that, provide that input?
I haven't given that much thought, Mr. Chairman, but I think trying to get their newsletter more widely distributed might be of some benefit. In other words, I get mine online, but I had not actually seen a hard copy myself.
You get it online because you go to the website, or you get it online because you get an email?
I get an email that advises me that it's out. All right. And of course, I think for our seniors that are connected, I know that's probably a good process, but I know for our members, less than half of our members are connected to the Internet, though. So.
And so then, do you take your information and put it in your own newsletter and get it out to your members?
We do sometimes, yeah. But our newsletter, as you probably know, Mr. Chairman, is fairly small, so we might make a reference to an article, but that's about all we were able to do.
All right. Any questions, Mr. Trivett?
Thanks very much.
Marie, Darlin, did you have any follow-up? Okay.
No, we testified last.
Okay, we have a couple people online who wanted to testify. First, we're going to go to Petersburg and Ruth Sandvik, and next, then we're going to go to Tanana or Fairbanks with Christine Earhart. Ms. Sandvik, are you online?
Yes, I am. I am Ruth Sandvik, and I think I come from the point of view of a customer of the Commission on the Aging. I commend you all for all your work, and I think we should all watch this program and listen to it so that we know the great amount of intelligence and planning that's behind the Commission on the Aging. I'm glad we're working with the federal government, but I want you to know I'm proud to be 88 years old and proud to be part of this program. And I don't have to tell you, fellas, that our need for a type of program like this will never go away. As was pointed out, the population of elderly people is increasing. So I'm just here to pat you all on the back and encourage you to continue this fine program. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Any questions, Ms. Sandvik? We don't have any questions, Ms. Sandvik, but keep in there and keep us honest.
Thanks.
Christine Earhart, are you there?
Hello?
Hi, Christine.
Hello, yes.
Can you identify yourself and give us your testimony, please?
My name is Christine Earhart, and I'm the Administrative Health Assistant for the Tanana Tribal Council. And I am also in support of extending the Alaska Commission on Aging. They are the exclusive funding agency for our Tanana Elders residents. And we have operated our Tanana Elders residents for over 20 years here in Tanana. And we feel that it's very important that this commission continues to exist. They're very supportive, and we're in favor of this extending it to 2008.
Thank you, Ms. Earhart. Any questions? There's no questions, Ms. Earhart. Thanks for joining us this morning.
You're welcome.
And there's no one else online, is that right, Beth? Okay. And is there anyone else present to testify? Okay. Karen, did you? No. We have no further testimony on public testimony on House Bill 394, Version A. Are there any comments or questions by the committee? If not, I need to correct the record. It is February 17th today, not the 16th. Representative Seaton.
Yeah, I think we've heard that the commission does a very good job, and I'm appreciative not only the pass-through funding that they handle, but also that I hope that they will bring other issues, continue to bring other issues to a that aren't necessarily financial as well, but that affect the aging and the senior population in our state. So I would like to move HB 394 with individual recommendations attached fiscal note.
Without objection, we shall move it with from committee House Bill 394 version A with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. Next on the agenda is the House Bill 329. We have before us the work draft on January 29 was moved by Representative Gruenberg. We have before us today the work draft of the committee substitute for House Bill 329, version H. There are two fiscal notes, and there's one from the Department of Administration, and then there's one with an attached letter from an actuarial, Mercer Human Resource Consulting. Do we have someone from the department here on 329?
Chairman Kevin Jardell, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Administration. We have the Director of Retirement and Benefits online, Melanie Milhorn, as well as someone from Mercer. So they'll be answering any questions.
Mr. Jardell, do you want to just stay here just in case?
I'd be happy to.
Okay. Melanie Milhorn, are you online?
I don't see anything with an actuary.
Melanie Milhorn, are you online?
Yes, I am.
Hi, Ms. Milhorn. If you could identify yourself for the record, please.
My name is Melanie Milhorn, and I'm the Director for Division of Retirement and Benefits.
Okay. Do you want to explain what was submitted to the committee by way of fiscal notes and any information submitted by your agency from Mercer Associates, please?
Yes, I would like to do that. I would also like to say that Kathy Lee, our retirement manager, is available to ask or to respond to any questions. And what we have provided to the committee right now includes a fiscal note that addresses the cost to administer House Bill 329. And that fiscal note looks at the positions and the resources needed to administer 329, and that's based on looking at the personnel and the resources that were dedicated for the RIP bill from 96 through 99, and then looking at our existing staff and resources and making some calculations on that.
Ms. Milhorn, we're going to take a quick at ease so everybody on the committee is certain to have this information. So we'll just go off record just for a moment till we. All right. Ms. Milhorn, I think we have, and I'm just going to identify for the record here, we have a fiscal note on HB 329. It doesn't say the bill version. The department affected is admin administration, and the date is 2/14/04. It's a two-page fiscal note. And then we have a fiscal note on department affected all, and it's dated 2/13/04. So go ahead, Ms. Milhorn, with your testimony. Sorry to interrupt.
All right. So the first fiscal note that you referred to and is identified, those are the costs that the division has estimated in order to administer the RIP legislation specific to House Bill 329. And then also, the committee had asked for a cost analysis associated with the cost to the employers to identify the population that would be eligible, which represents the Tier 1 members for PERS and for TERS. And I have with me online Bob Reynolds, who is our actuarial consultant, who prepared the cost analysis associated with the employer costs. So I hope that he's online.
Mr. Reynolds, are you there? Mr. Reynolds?
Sorry, they just unmuted me. I am online.
Hi, Mr. Reynolds. Could you identify yourself for the record, please?
Yeah. My name is Bob Reynolds, and I'm with Mercer Human Resource Consulting. We work with the division and with the respective boards for the public employees retirement system and the teachers retirement system.
Go ahead. Ms. Milhorn was deferring to you to provide testimony, Mr. Reynolds.
Yes. Yeah, we are the actuaries for the two systems.
I understand.
I've been muted and unmuted a couple times here, so if I cut out, it may be that I've been muted.
You're not muted.
Okay, thank you.
Bob, could you just walk through, the committee members have the fiscal note that has the cost for the employer specific to PERS and TERS and what that cost would be for the various different parties to RIP. Could you walk the committee members through the underlying basis for that actuarial analysis?
Yes. What we have done is estimated the value of the benefits that would be provided under the Retirement Incentive Program, under House Bill 329, compared to the value of the benefits that the members expected to be eligible would receive in the absence of House Bill 329. In other words, what we have done is estimated the incremental cost of the proposed legislation. And we have found that the incremental cost is as shown in the fiscal note. It's in two places. It's in the fiscal note, and it's also in the letter from Mercer that's attached to the fiscal note. For PERS, we found that the incremental cost was $786.3 million. And for TERS, for the teachers, we found that the incremental cost was $431.6 million. And I'm happy to provide further explanations about the methodology and the assumptions behind that. Or to simply explain further what those numbers mean.
Your $436 million, where is that in your – is this you're referring to your February 13 letter to Ms. Milhorn?
Yes. At the top of the first page describes some of the assumptions that we used in calculating these costs and the basis for it. At the top of the second page, you will see the very first paragraph shows the total employer cost. And you'll see the $786.3 million for PERS there and the $431.6 million for TERS.
Okay, I'm with you. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
Any questions, Representative Seaton?
Yeah. an explanation on this. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now, this is the cost. Is this additional cost to what those same people retiring at with a non-RIP program would be, or is,
yes.
Or is it their entire retirement eligibility, and then we would have to subtract their retirement schedule if they worked another 2 or 3 years and then retired?
No, this represents the incremental cost only, so this is the cost over and above the cost of the benefits that they've earned in the absence of House Bill 329. This represents additional cost, and you don't need to subtract anything off.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thanks. Any further questions, Mr. Reynolds? Representative Grunberg and then Representative Cockfield.
No, I didn't.
I mean, Representative Berkowitz and Representative Cockfield.
Thanks very much. Your letter assumes that all RIP-eligible people will take advantage of the RIP. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correect. So this, in essence, is the maximum cost. Clearly, if fewer than all of those eligible took the RIP, then the cost would be less.
Historically, what percentage of people who are eligible take RIPs?
I defer that question to Melanie and to Kathy Lee at the division.
Okay. If they can answer that, if they can hear, that'd be great.
Mr. Hilliard, you seem itching to testify. No, okay.
The second question I have,
Representative Berkowitz. Representative Berkowitz, Ms. Lee's on the line. Why don't we just take these okay. So we don't lose progress? Ms. Lee, can you identify yourself for the record, please?
Yes, my name is Kathy Lee, and I'm the retirement manager for the Division of Retirement and Benefits.
Okay, can you respond to Representative Berkowitz's question?
During the last RIP, we had 10,500 PERS members eligible. 1,359 of them actually retired, so that represents about 13%.
Okay.
And of our TERS population, we had about 3,200 who were eligible, 850 actually retired, which was about 26%.
So, I mean, if this were really a great RIP program, you might get 20% of the people that jump on it.
Yes.
Okay. So these numbers would come down considerably.
Yes, they would.
Okay. The second question is, when you talk about present value, on the second page, you're talking about the present value of the benefits?
Yes.
That's the extending out over how long a period?
Well, that's the value in today's dollars of the additional benefits, and the methodology that the systems use to fund for that has been to pay for cost increases over 25 years.
Okay, so this, when you talk about present value, you're talking about extending out the value of services that might take place 25 years from now. That's included in your calculation.
I'm not sure I fully understood the question, so let me explain a little bit, and then you can tell me if I answered the question. The numbers shown represent the total cost increase that the systems would incur in total. And so it represents the difference between the benefits that the eligible members receive under the RIP, assuming they get the extra service and retire within the window period, versus the benefits that they would receive if they stayed within the system to their assumed retirement age under our valuation assumptions, and then retired without, of course, the extra RIP service. Now, actuarially, the method that the systems use to fund for the program benefits is to attempt to fund for benefits over the lifetime of the membership, which generally is about 25 years.
Okay, but
Representative Berkowitz,
my sort of quick back of the envelope calculation is that this is $100,000 per employee. Is that right?
We had, let's see, 8,000 PERS members. For PERS, what I had found was a cost of, yes, you're right, roughly $100,000. And for TERS, it's actually a bit higher. It's about $120,000-some per member.
So we're talking $100,000 benefit for an individual over 25-year period of time?
To be paid for over a 25-year period of time, but the value of the additional benefits is exactly the roughly $100,000 per member.
Right, and neglecting, if we did this in just a straight analysis rather than using future value or present value, that would be approximately $4,000 per year per person?
Yeah, that's right.
So
neglecting, as you say, that the time value of money and present value calculation.
So if we save more than $4,000 a year per person, this is a good deal for the state.
I think I should back up a little bit.
Well, maybe you can begin by laying out what goes into your present value calculation.
Yeah. What we look at is the value of the benefits that they would receive under the RIP, HB 329, which means we assume, first of all, that they will get the extra service as outlined in the proposed legislation, and that they would then retire within the RIP period. And so they would, at that point, begin receiving both their pension benefit and whatever medical benefits they are eligible for. So thinking if the window were to occur today, for example, they would immediately start receiving a pension benefit that's based on 3 additional years of service, and they would begin receiving medical benefits. We contrast that against the benefits that they would receive in the absence of the investment program, where they don't get the extra service, where they remain in employment until our assumed retirement ages, and they don't begin collecting pension benefits or medical benefits until that time. And as you calculated from the figures, the average incremental cost per member is roughly $100,000 or $120,000, depending on the system. Now, I think it would be unrealistic, given the age of the membership and who's eligible, to expect that they would stick around for 25 years. So although the actuarial methodology for the system does typically pay for benefits over a 25-year period, for this membership, the future working lifetime is, of course, expected to be much less, because they are generally already at or fairly close to retirement age. So I think that you would divide these figures by a much shorter time period in order to get the annual cost savings that you would need to have.
Okay. My point is that these numbers look huge, but when you break them down and start analyzing them, they're not that big. I mean, if you wanted to get $100,000 25 years from now at 8% interest, that's probably about somewhere in the neighborhood of $20,000 of today's dollars if you just compound it. Is that about right?
Mr. Lee, or Mr.
Yes, it's actually a little bit less than $20,000. But remember, the $120,000 isn't the value that you want to have in 25 years, or by the time these people would ordinarily retire. It's the amount of money that you would need to set aside now. So it's not the funding target in 25 years. It's the number that you would need to set aside now to pay it off in full. You can think of it as the principal on a mortgage. If you were buying a house now, your mortgage payment isn't constructed so that you accumulate the principal in 25 years. Your mortgage payment is higher because the principal payment is the value of the house now.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Reynolds. Further questions, Mr. Reynolds?
Somebody else.
Sure. Representative Eaton?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm curious, so basically what we're talking about here, although we're breaking this down to individual costs, what we're concerned on is not the individual costs or benefit. We're interested in the cumulative debt to the retirement system, or the cumulative liability that the retirement system would acquire from this program. So am I understanding then that because that's what we have to service. I mean, if we're, as I understand it, and I hope you'll explain it to me if I understand it wrong, that we are charging TERS percentages and PERS percentages, and they've gone up because we've got an accumulated debt amount or payout amount. And so if these figures that you're giving us here, or the 20% of those, would have to increase other retirees, or the state's contribution for other retirees in the current system to pay this accumulated indebtedness. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. If you use the PERS system as an example, the unfunded liability in the PERS system As of the most recently completed valuation, which at this point is at the end of fiscal 2002, the PERS unfunded liability was $2.6 billion. If that were to be increased by the full RIP cost of, let's say it's roughly 0.8 billion, then the approximate increase in the rate that would be incurred would be in the range of 3 to 4% of system payroll.
Okay, just follow up. So then, regardless of the employer contribution that's made up front, then the state contribution for every retiree would have to go up. And what was that, 3 to 3.5, 4%? Did you say? I didn't get it written.
Yeah, 3 to 4%.
3 to 4%.
And that's for all, you know, that's for system wide pay. So that is for the entire system, not just for the affected members.
Okay. And of course that 3 to 4% is assuming 100% participation. So if we were 20% participation, then we would be at 20% of that 3 to 4%. Is that?
Yeah, that's generally correct. I would be a little cautious in using ratios like that, because typically what happens is, although we're working with average costs, the members who would actually take advantage of the retirement of the program would be those whose average cost is higher than the average. The members who would take advantage would be the ones who would benefit most. So I would actually expect, for example, if 20% of membership took it, that the cost would be more than 20% of the total cost we've shown here. But certainly it would be at least that.
And is that because they're at the higher end of the pay scale?
Yeah, it's what we call anti-selection. You know, it's the fact that the people who take advantage of the program will be those who benefit most, not those who benefit least.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Anti-selection.
Hey, it's an insurance term.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two things. First of all, and I guess maybe I want to ask this to Ms. Milhorn rather than Mr. Reynolds, looking at the other fiscal note, bottom of page 2, estimating that 2 permanent employees will be needed and 6 long-term non-permanent employees. Focusing on the 2 permanent employees, does that assume full participation?
No, I think we looked at that in relation to the parties who had retired in 96 through 99 and looking at those staffing levels that we needed during that time period, looking at the existing staffing that we have right now and making a determination about the staffing level that would be necessary. So we did not, you know, look at the universe of the possible to say that all of those parties would take advantage of this RIP legislation.
As I understand it, these programs are supposed to save the state money because they then would allow some positions to remain unfilled or become filled by lower paid employees. Is not that correct?
That's the intent behind the legislation. That's correct.
Yet I don't see any of that reflected in the fiscal notes.
Well, the fiscal note that we prepared for the division doesn't look at the savings. It looks at the resources that we need in order to provide the adequate staffing level in order to allow those parties to retire.
I understand, but I don't see, and maybe I'm talking to the bill sponsor or to Mr. Jardine or somebody, I don't see any fiscal note or any indication here showing the other side of the equation, and I'm wondering if somebody could please speak to that.
To the chair, Representative Greenberg.
Kevin Jardel. It's difficult to show the savings. I mean, the way the legislation is set up, the intent, I believe, is that it absolutely has to be a neutral cost, and that on top of that, you would have some savings. So what our actuarial has done is looked at our costs in any particular instance when they present the plan for a RIP to the Department Administration. They're going to have to go through OMB, say, here's the cost of doing this individual. How are we going to achieve the savings to offset those costs? And it's going to have to work out mathematically, at least be neutral. And then there potentially could be additional savings, but those are too distant and too far removed to try and put into a fiscal note. I mean, the bill assumes it'll be a zero cost, or you can't do it. And so I think the more important analysis is to look at what the cost per employee is, and then how likely it is that we will achieve enough savings to offset that cost to just reach the neutral requirements of the legislation.
So to help me through understand the legislation, the legislation authorizes but doesn't require you to do that. Is that correct?
It's my understanding, and I, having gone through the work draft, that the legislation requires that it be a neutral cost savings before we can authorize it.
Okay, that answers my question. Thank you.
I could be wrong if I could correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm not sure that was picked up on the record. If you wanted to have that on the record, Mr. Okay, Representative C.
Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out neutral cost. Does that mean that we would save money in current administrative terms, and yet we would shift the cost, the expense, to the retirement system? I mean, we're picking up a huge liability to the retirement system potentially in this, and so we could have neutral costs, but we could be generating savings in payments for new employees, but we could be putting a huge liability unmatched by the cost savings onto the retirement system. Have you
position, how does that transfer over to the liability of the PERS system?
That's right. Correct.
Mr. Jardel.
I could. Ask OMB. Jack Reinheder's here with OMB to answer that.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jack Reinheder with the Office of Management and Budget. And through the chair, Representative Seaton, the way the bill works is as far as your question on the liability to the retirement system, the bill requires that liability to be offset to allow before an employee can be allowed to participate. So, in other words, the employee is required to contribute 3 years of their contributions, which is about 6%
per year.
It varies, I believe, by bargaining unit. So they kick in, say, roughly 18-20% of their salary to contribute their 3 years of retirement contributions. And then the employer is required to pick up the difference. So using the numbers that we're talking about today for PERS, for example, if the cost per employee is about $100,000 for these additional retirement benefits under the bill, the employee would cover kick in their 3 years of contributions. The employer would have to pick up the balance. So say the employee's 3 years of contributions worked out to $1,000, the employer would have to pick up the remaining $80,000, write a check to whether it's a state agency or a municipality or a school district, and write a check to the Division of Retirement and Benefits for that amount. So the intent is to be cost neutral for the retirement system. In other words, under the analysis that Mercer did, and of course it's not completely realistic because not every single employee is going to participate or show a cost savings that would qualify them to participate. But just using the numbers, for example, for PERS, the $432 million figure roughly. If every single employee participated, the state and all the municipalities would be writing checks to the PERS system for that $432 million. So the way the legislation is set up, it is intended to be cost neutral, although Mr. Reynolds did point out in his letter, I believe, that there is some risk of, I believe it's the last sentence of his letter, where he says that future changes such as increased longevity or higher than anticipated medical costs may affect the ultimate cost neutrality of the program. So there are a couple of caveats to that, but the intent is going in to be cost neutral.
Representative Seaton and Representative Berkowitz.
Thank you. And this is kind of where my problem area lies, is that we've just gone through a increase in PERS and TERS of 4% and 5%, according to the actuarial stuff that we presented in education. Those numbers, you know, to fund the balance should be at 34% and 35% of employee salaries. So there's a probability that it's going to go up from the 16% contribution rate this year. Next year, I mean, there's a limit on how much it can go up each year, but those are escalating. We had a 3.5% change in 2002 from the 7.5% for health care to now 12% for health care. We just had a federal government come out and say they've got a new longevity table adopted this year that's going to be extending the longevity another 2 or 2.5 years. And my concern is that those are the exact caveats that this says are going to make it a deficit to the program if we don't include those. And yet, it doesn't seem to be that we're funding those up front at all or including those even in the calculation. Is that, am I off the base in those assumptions or in the understanding?
Your concern is valid through the chair, Representative Seaton. Any unanticipated increases in cost down the road, whether it's health insurance, longevity, other factors, would mean that the RIP program wouldn't be fully cost neutral. All the costs that are expected today are built into the calculations, but any unanticipated ones are not.
Yeah, a couple of quick points. I mean, I'm sure the Finance Committee is going to have a good time devouring all these numbers. It would be helpful, I think, at that point also, since this has some serious repercussions for the municipalities and the boroughs, if there was some input from perhaps AML or from some of the municipalities that are going to be impacted. So it's just a suggestion as this bill moves along.
So Rose, did you want to testify today or? Representative Seaton, you had a question?
Yeah, I had one more curiosity here. If this is the structure of this is that it's revenue neutral, why would we, Mercer, be saying that we're looking at a 3 to 4% increase if everybody takes it, or a 0.6 to 0.8 increase in everybody's rate of contribution? Because by the definition of what you were saying is that this 100,000 or 120 that would have to be made up by the employee and the employee present dollar input, there shouldn't be any effect on the rates at all. And if we're getting a 3 to 4% rate increase, that seems to be significantly out of balance.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I think there may have been some confusion on that point. And if I understood the question correctly, right, I believe Mr. Reynolds' response was that the dollar amounts reflected in his letter for the total potential cost to the system if every eligible employee participated, that would be equivalent to a 3 to 4% rate increase. But that would only be if these contributions were not made. And correct me if I'm misunderstanding your response, Bob, but again, that would be if these contributions were not made. If the required contributions were made, the only risk of a rate increase would be from these unanticipated future costs, like higher medical costs or higher longevity. Bob, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, that's correct. The rate increase was by way of expressing it in equivalent costs. One other point of clarity to Mr. Kreinheider's remarks. In general, they were right on target. The one thing I might point out, though, is that the employee indebtedness has already been taken into account in these figures. So when you were quoting the average cost of $100,000 and the member would actually pay $20,000 of that, that $20,000 has already been taken into account. And you'll see that at the top of our letter where we say the total employer cost is equal to the increase in the total present value of benefits minus member indebtedness to be paid to the systems. So this is the employer portion only, and the member portion has already been taken out of the equation.
For the record, that was Mr. Reynolds. Follow-up, Representative Seat?
No, thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I did have one other point of information in response to Representative Berkowitz's question on participation rates from prior programs. The Ms. Lee cited some figures for the systems as a whole, and I just wanted to point out that for the state of Alaska, just looking at the state of Alaska, the participation rates were a bit higher. And I think Ms. Lee's figures reflect the fact that some municipalities and school districts did not opt to participate in the prior program. But for the figures for the state, for example, statewide totals, including state agencies, university, the legislature, and the court system, in the prior program, there were about 26, using round numbers, about 2,600 employees that were approved to participate. Of those, about 1,250 actually applied for and retired under the program. So it was a little bit less than 50% in terms of participation rate for employees who are actually offered the opportunity.
A quick question. There's a number of people living in Alaska who are retired. They're members of the TERS and PERS system now. Is there any possible way that this bill is going to affect their benefits under their current retirement programs?
I defer on that question to the Department of Administration or
I think the
Bob
simple
Reynolds.
Answer is no.
Simple answer is no. I need a lead pipe cinch answer because the retirees in the state fundamentally are concerned about their retirement benefits. And anything that it might impair their contractual rights to those kind of obligations from the state, which they've worked long and hard for, needs definitive answers so they can represent to their members that this bill will not affect you.
And the definitive answer is still no.
Okay. Is that good, Mr. Trivett? Okay. We also have some other folks online, unless there's anybody in the committee who wants to address anything. These folks. I also wanted to just get a short take on this bill. The idea, the policy reason, the policy underpinning for a bill like this is to provide a cost-neutral way for the state to move out high-income employees and replace them with lower-paid, newer employees. Is that the fundamental basis for this kind of a bill?
Through the chair, Kevin Jardo, I think that's my understanding of the sponsor's intent, but defer to the sponsor.
In the state's experience with RIP bills, is that in the past policy basis for previous RIP bills that the legislature's passed?
Through the chair, we have gone and we have looked into what the past experience has been. Mr. Kreinheiter was certainly a part of that in the past, and I think he can testify to our past experience.
Mr. Kreinheiter.
I'm sorry, could you run the question by me?
I just want to make sure that it's from the administration's view, the policy basis for a bill like this is to allow the higher paid employees of the state system to retire and bring in newer, lower paid employees to fill positions. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, the justification for the prior RIPs were to help avoid layoffs, absorb some of the cost increases that the departments were facing. And specifically in your question as far as replacing higher paid employees with lower, in the last RIP under the prior administration from 96 through 2000, there was more of an emphasis on trying to delete positions or reclassify them downward where agencies were reorganizing their operations and trying to streamline their operations. So it can be either replacing with lower paid employees or deleting positions. On that point, I think it's important to note that the and might be helpful for the committee that using the numbers that Mercer has provided, the number of employees who will show a savings and would be eligible to participate, especially where positions are not being eliminated, but you're replacing, you know, a range 18M with a range 18A, the number of employees who are likely to qualify is likely to be much less, because you've heard the number that Mr. Reynolds cited of the cost per employee that the employer would have to contribute to the system is about $100,000. In the last RIP, it was only about $28,000. And as Mr. Reynolds has noted in his letter, there's some reasons there for higher health insurance costs, greater longevity, and so on. But what that means is that it would be much more difficult for the savings to pencil out for replacing a range 18M with an 18A. If you did eliminate the position, the savings are calculated over 3 years. So if you did eliminate the position and compared that to the cost of keeping the position filled for 3 years, depending on the salary level and the individual employee, you could show a savings. But I just wanted to point out that it will be much harder for the numbers to pencil out using these higher costs.
Thank you. Just as a follow-up, we heard before that 13% roughly for the last RIP system retired. So would we then say, given this scenario, since it costs more to buy the 3 years, that it's going to be 10% or 8%? Or what number is a reasonable number for us to utilize? 75% of the people would choose to do so?
Through the chair, Representative Holm, frankly, I wouldn't hazard a guess on that. And even going back to my desk and trying to crunch some numbers on it, I'm not sure I could really answer your question. All I could say is that the number of employees that would qualify is likely to be substantially less. But I'll try to see if I can quantify that. But it's the employee cost that a department or a municipality has to kick in varies by each individual employee, so it's very difficult to predict. All I really have to work with are the averages from the prior program and the new Mercer figures. But
I guess what my question was not what you had to kick in necessarily or the employer has to kick in, but what the employee has to kick in. If that's higher, that's going to be the people aren't going to want to retire as quickly, I would suspect. So you have two things going on there.
Through the chair, Representative Holm, my understanding is the employee contribution would not change from the prior RIP. There, to my knowledge, we constitutionally cannot increase the. Correct me if I'm wrong, Bob or Melanie, but my understanding is that constitutionally we cannot. It's a contract with the employee, so the state can't unilaterally increase the employee contribution rate. We can certainly increase the employer contribution rate. But, for example, for state employees, the employee rate is, I think it's 6 or 7%. So that hasn't changed from the prior RIP. So from the employee's perspective, they would not have to pay more or it wouldn't be less attractive.
Paid before.
That's correct.
Okay.
The problem is that the employer cost is nearly four times what it was in the last RIP. So it will be difficult to show a savings from
replacing relatively high paid employees with new lower paid employees.
And this is Melanie, and yes, Jack is correct. The employee contribution rate would not be changed. That is set by statute for PERS at 6.75%.
That, for the record, that was Ms. Milhorn. Representative Seaton?
Yes, I'm just curious about the PERS rate and the TERS rate are set in statute. However, this is a new statute offering a new contract that is not a mandatory. So is there anything that prevents us from increasing the PERS and TERS contribution rate if somebody wants to take the RIP? I mean, it's a voluntary program. It's not a mandatory program. Is there anything legally that prevents us from saying that if you want to retire under this RIP, you're going to have to contribute 10%?
Through the chair, Kevin Jardell, I think what you'd be looking at under the legislation is, since they're retiring, their employer contributions would no longer be there. What you'd be looking at is the bill specifically establishes what percentage they have to put in before they retire. So the 20% or so that they were referring to earlier as the employees part of buying into the RIP, that's where you could change in the legislation. You'd have the ability to say, well, instead of 20%, you're going to have to pick up 40% or 30%. But once they enter into the retirement program, they don't have the chance to contribute.
Yeah, that was the point that I was trying to put down, because it seems like in this program we've been assuming that the employee rate was fixed, whereas it's an offering and it doesn't necessarily have to be fixed, so maybe some way to approach it.
Yes, sir.
I noticed in the administrative fiscal note, it also says that in addition, on the second page, second line, in addition, this bill allows for separation bonuses for state employees. Are those, is there any limits on those, or are there any calculations on those? I don't see that calculated anywhere into here.
Yeah, Mr. Hilliard, do you want to come forward?
For the record, my name is Heath Hilliard, staff representative McGuire. Through the chair, Representative Seaton, the new version, draft H, which you haven't actually formally, I mean, you've adopted for discussion purposes, but I believe none of the working draft, has deleted all reference to the separation incentive program. So there is no longer a separation incentive program under version H, presuming that that is the version you pass out.
If I could make one comment on the administrative portion of it. Although when you look at it, certainly 100% of the people will not participate in it, it will be close to that or greater than that as far as inquire about the program. And so when we talk about the administrative portion and retirement benefits ramping up to put a program like this in order based on past experience, if not 12,000, and probably a lot of people who aren't eligible will contact Retirement Benefits Office and have them go through the analysis and explain all the ifs and buts about this program. And it is a tremendous amount of resources that goes into a program like that. So even though not everyone will end up participating in the RIP program, there is a lot of resources just in explaining it to people and giving out that type of information. We will get a lot of calls from people who are already retired. What is this going to do to my retirement? Those type of things take a lot of resources to walk people through all that. So that's been taken into account, especially looking back on the past RIP programs and what our experience was with administrative costs.
Bart, just to follow up on your earlier testimony, if somebody who's already retired calls up and says, what's the impact on my retirement, the answer is nothing. Is that correct?
Through the chair, that's correct, but those types of answers aren't always enough with people on the line. Sometimes it takes a really walking.
I understand. I just want to make sure that that's clear for those who are already retired.
And Melanie, if I'm wrong there, please jump in.
Representative Seaton?
You are correct.
That was Ms. Milhorn for the record. Ms. Milhor, if you could identify yourself before you speak, that'd be great. Representative Seaton.
Thank you. And so I assume that administration is going to redo this fiscal note based on, I mean, it's from the 14th, but I guess apparently this is addressing the older version of the bill that no longer applies.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, we will update it as soon as this committee, or if this committee adopts and passes out a CS, we will prepare a new fiscal note for that CS.
Thank you. We have a number of other people who want to testify here, too, but the committee, go ahead, Representative Seaton, and then Representative Groomberg.
Just one other thing. In the fiscal note here, it says that reemployment into deferred deters or DRS or option, you know, university retirement after the apportionment to the RIP would require all members to repay 110% of the amount that they received under the RIP. Wasn't there a bill that was passed last year that allowed people to come back and teach under TERS without having to repay the TERS contribution?
Mr. Chair, this is Kathy Lee.
Go ahead, Ms. Lee.
The bill that passed out allowing a retired employee to reemploy did not apply to RIP employees. They were expressly excluded from that legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lee. Representative Groomberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Groomberg. Mr. Lee, do you have a follow-up to that?
I just wanted to, through the chair, thank you, Representative Rybrock, I wanted to point out to Representative Seaton that there are two specific provisions in the H version with regard to reemployment as they pertain to school districts and school districts only.
Thank you. Thanks, Mr. Hillage. Representative Groomberg, sorry to interrupt.
If I may, just on that point, are you referring to Section 9 of the bill, Mr. Hillage?
I believe it is Section 9.
Because I read that to apply not only to school districts, but it could also apply to local governments, municipalities, because it refers on page 10, line 1, to employers other than the state.
Right.
That would seem to be both. Am I right?
Through the chair, Representative Groomberg, I believe on that particular point you are correct. The point I was referring to, and I apologize, is at the top of page 11, with regard to an individual may accept employment with a school district as a substitute teacher, and an individual participating in the TERS system may accept employment with a school district if the employment is on an hourly basis. But the language you're referring to, I believe, comes from previous versions of the RIP. So you are correct on that point. Correct.
Mr. Chairman, what I'm wondering, and this may be something that ought to be directed to somebody from the AML or somebody else, is what kind of liability Section 9 may subject our municipalities to, and if that's been fully considered, because I could see that busting the bank potentially in some of our smaller or larger municipalities. Would you like to comment on that, anybody?
I know we do have some other folks who want to testify. I know that
I can leave that hanging out. But I have another question.
Sure, go ahead.
But I would ask somebody to address that as well. Now, the thing that concerns me a bit, it seems to me that the key triggering mechanism is found on page 2, lines 19 to 21, which focuses, and this is the eligibility of any particular employee. If it's a savings to the employer in personnel services cost, or the employee's position will exceed the costs to the employer for that position, that is the conditional phrase and the key to the whole bill, it seems to me. I may be misreading it, but that does not require any look at what this retirement, an individual retirement, will do to the retirement system at all. There's no requirement that the impact on the retirement system be examined. Am I misreading it? And if so, is that a potential danger to the retirement system because there's no requirement that that be examined?
Representative Grimberg, through the chair, I think you make a very good point there, and as a representative of the sponsor, I think that if we can work on language that would address those concerns, particularly the long-term impacts to the respective retirement systems, we'd be happy to include that. Certainly our intent is not to create a problematic situation or to further exacerbate existing problems with the retirement systems, merely to provide a very flexible, optional tool to agencies, municipalities, and school districts for potential personnel reductions.
Thank you. Mr. Hillier, I'm looking at my friend, the chair of the committee, because we had a little amendment that I offered last week on a bill that would provide some potential tax benefits for police who moved into high-crime areas, and the very wise, I think, chair of the committee suggested a conceptual hold harmless amendment for the state. And maybe we need to have that kind of conceptual hold harmless amendment for the pension system here in this bill, or we could have a serious problem. And so I'd like you to consider that, because I think I might offer that when we mark this bill up. And if I'm hearing you, it sounds like you don't have any objection to that concept. Am I right?
Through the chair, yes, that's correct, Representative Grunberg.
Okay, well, when we mark this up, I'll do that. But I have one final thing, Mr. Chairman. And that is, it looks to me like for the court system, and I don't see Mr. Woolover here, who told me informally that he didn't think the court system would participate. It looks to me like the only person from the court system who's allowed to participate in this is one employee. And that is found in Section 8 on page 8 of the bill, and that's the administrative director, who's Stephanie Cole. Is that the only person in the court system who's allowed to participate in this?
Through the chair, I can't really respond to that. I honestly don't know.
Maybe I'm misreading this.
Yeah, I don't. This was... Ms. Milhorn, can you respond to that, since admin prepared the fiscal note? It says that the director, if the member is a member of the judicial retirement system, I'm not sure if that means they're a former judge or if they're a member of the judicial retirement system.
Mr. Chairman, the key language is on page...
I was reading from the fiscal note.
No, we got to look at the bill.
Right, sure.
The bill itself is on page 8, line 11. The Chief Justice may adopt a retirement incentive plan for an administrative director of the court system who is a member of the judicial retirement system.
That's reflected in the fiscal note. That's why I was reading there.
And my recollection is that was the Snowden Amendment many years ago, which was a very interesting amendment that we won't go into the history on, but it seems to me it applies to one person in the state. Maybe Ms. Milhorn, you'd care to comment on that?
Mr. Chair, this is Kathy Lee.
Yes, Ms. Lee.
The provision stated there is to provide only for one person of the judicial retirement system to be approved for a RIP, and that is the administrative director of the court. Other court system employees who are members of PERS would participate as state employees.
Mr. Chairman, those are the administrative folks, but there are no people, I stand corrected, there's nobody in the judicial retirement system who's allowed to rip out under this bill, right?
That's correct, sir.
Is there a reason for that? Now, I know they don't plan to participate, but maybe some judge would like to participate.
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Jardel. Through the chair, Representative Grimberg, this is not an administration bill. The bill sponsor is sitting here, and I think that would be a more appropriate question to the bill sponsor.
I didn't mean to put you on the hot seat, nor Mr. Hillier. I'm simply asking anybody who wants to respond.
Through the chair, Representative Grimberg, this is, to kind of give you a background on this bill, this is essentially a copy or a very similar version of that which we took from Representative Katula from several years ago. That particular omission was not intentional either way. It can be included back in or doesn't need to be.
I'm sure it was at the time because that's about when Mr. Snowden retired.
But with respect to our motive intent, that there was no particular motive there.
Thank you, Mr. Hilliard. Thanks, Representative Greenberg. Is there any further questions? I'd like to get this public testimony for the committee and complete that, and then we're going over schedule, but we have online. Let's do online, and then we'll come back here to, you know, we have Marv St. Clair and Soldatna. Mr. St. Clair, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
If you want to identify yourself for the record and give your testimony, please. Go ahead, Mr. St. Clair.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Now, I've just re-instructed on how to use your speaker system. My name is Marv St. Clair. I reside in Soldotna, Alaska. And I work for Central Emergency Services, our rural service area, fire EMS department in Soldotna. My concern with House Bill 329 is it was introduced last year and put into committee and then never came out of committee. Myself and obviously many of us within the department have watched the progress of this bill, and we all would like to encourage both the people that would fall under the RIP program and those that would not, that the committees continue to work together to move this bill along. I have a little over 25, 26 years of service, which 18 are full-time paid, and obviously I would qualify if this bill was approved at the state legislature this year for early out. Of age where I have plans or goals that I would like to go back to school and to become additionally trained and then return back to the state of Alaska to continue to work for another 10, 12, 15 years into an area that I think they're looking for employees, and on the medical side as a physician's assistant. So obviously I have personal reasons to follow this bill closely and I'll obviously support it wholeheartedly. But I would like, after listening to the committee speak, I would like to go refer back to the Section 2, lines 19 through 21. And we look at that at the borough as a borough employee. I believe the last time the RIP program came through, it had to be approved by the borough assembly that the Kenai Peninsula borough would participate. And then it went to the actual individual service area board of directors who also had to approve the particular service area participating. And the number one rule on the consideration is that there had to be an actual cost savings to allow a senior, if you will, employee to leave or rip out early and then bring somebody in which is receiving a substantially less amount for a wage. And that's what we've looked at. Now, listening to your testimony, I understand that you know, you're looking at the overall impact of the PERS system itself at the state, which, you know, I don't know if I got my questions answered on that or not. But the other issue that I would like you to consider here and understand is I understand that each individual department commissioner, et cetera, just like the municipality or the boroughs as well, have a right to participate or also have the right to not participate. And I think that, I don't know how you figure that into your overall calculations when you're looking at accrual costs, but I think that needs to be looked at as well. Thank you.
Hi, thanks very much, sir. Are there questions for Mr. St. Clair? Representative Grunberg?
Mr. St. Clair, to the chair, you say we need to look at accrual costs. I gather that's in addition to, quote, personal services costs. On line 19 of page 2, is that an additional term of art you're using, quote, accrual costs, sir?
Negative. I'm speaking in a general term that I guess each department or each department commissioner, if you will, or each Berlin entity, finance directors, et cetera, at the borough level would have to look at the overall cost, whether they would participate or not. Obviously, if you have a department that has few employees that are highly trained, that would be very hard to replace. I would think that department head, according to what you have drafted here, would have a right to not participate in the program. Am I correct?
Mr. Chair, if I may continue. What I'm wondering, since we're looking at the exact language of the bill, do you happen to have a copy of the bill in front of you, sir?
Yes.
Okay, I'm on page 2, line 19 of the H version. It's section 2, subsection B3. Savings to the employer in personal services costs. Do you see that language, personal services costs?
Yes, I do.
Do you believe the term personal services may be too narrow and we should not limit it to personal services costs, but include other possible types of costs?
It's a consideration when you make that statement, but then if you're starting to branch off in what I would call a left field and trying to say what would be politically correct here, look at what may occur in the future, whether the cost may go up or down, I think you also need to branch off into the right field and consider what would happen if a fair amount of the employees that did participate in the RIP actually did not exist after several years and did not reach the 25-year projected participation in the program. I look at that as a quick statement as of what if. What if this happened? What if that happened? And I think overall we all could what if this whole program to death. I like how it's worded there. I think it's plain English. I think it's well understood that before anybody could participate at my level, there has to be a definite cost to whoever is paying those personnel expenses, and I think it should be kept where it's at.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Gruber. Thank you, Mr. St. Clair. Any further questions? I don't think anyone else is online. Is that correct? Okay. But Mr. Rose, why don't you come forward, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Carl Rose, Executive Director of the Association of Alaska School Boards. Right off the top, we support this bill and hopefully the marked-up version that you're going to be working on. If I could share with you, I do appreciate the discussion because we, too, are concerned about cost neutral. We're concerned about solvency. We're concerned about the actuarial soundness of what we're preparing to do. I was first elected to a school board in 1974, and the world looked very different then. We could no way project what these programs would look like 30 years later. And I think you're faced with the same questions now. We're having to ask ourselves actuarially, what will be the anticipated costs of a future that we don't even see yet? Nonetheless, our concern is that this is an economic tool that we can use in school districts to, if you will, manage the decline of the public schools. We've been doing it for about a decade and a half now. So our inability to keep pace with an adequate level of funding, the increased state and federal mandates that we are under, that are redirecting the resources of school districts, decreased capacity in our schools to meet the expectations that are being set forth, the inability to attract and retain qualified teachers and administrators, all of these things we're faced with, and we're looking anywhere we can to create savings. And if this bill can provide a level of savings, we will eat the seed corn. We'll eat the seed corn if we have to. We have a tremendous responsibility, as I know you do, and so I encourage you to take a look at the issues that you're dealing with now. Try to address the issue of solvency and actuarial soundness, and meanwhile, provide some level of latitude at the local levels. Ideally, you didn't think I'd let you go without saying this, ideally, adequacy in funding is what we are looking for. It's what we need, and what we're asking for you today is a result of a lack of keeping pace with buying power and inflation over the last decade and a half. With that, I just would reiterate that we support this bill in concept, and we hope that you look at all of the elements of solvency and actuarial soundness.
Mr. Rose, there's the policy implications of this bill on school districts. On the one hand, you have a financial savings that allows you to allow for that higher paid teachers would be tired and allowing you to hire newer ones at a lower cost, theoretically. Is that right?
That is correct.
Would staff at school districts also be affected by the bill? They could take an early retirement?
As was mentioned earlier, we look at this bill as an optional bill. We can decide to take advantage of it or not. The brain drain is tremendous. You have people that you'd like to retain. You have economic pressure that you have to deal with. And so there are two sides of this bill all the way down the line. So as the question is put to us, I think when we start to take a look at the PERS and TERS crisis we're in right now and the actions of the PERS and TERS boards and what impact that will have on employers in terms of increased rates, I think that's going to factor in to the ability of school districts to be able to afford some of this. But nonetheless, I think it's something we have to look at. If it is a cost savings and cost neutral, I think school districts will probably look favorably upon it. But if that initial cost where employee rates go up at an alarming rate, that will have an impact on whether they take advantage of something like this or not.
There's a number of questions. You mentioned a brain drain. Would this bill exacerbate a brain drain by allowing those teachers that have been around a long time that have a lot of skills, experience, benefits to the class, move out of the system in exchange for bringing those in that don't have the kind of experience? Do the students or the districts get negatively affected in that respect?
Mr. Chairman, I think it's safe to say that when you take someone who's spent a career in the profession, there are some talents that they possess that new people coming to the system simply don't have the experience. So I would imagine that that has an effect. That has to be weighed. There are many people who are attracted to retiring early. I mean, many of our teachers are highly talented. They're underpaid and would like to pursue a second career. This is an opportunity for them to do that. And I think a school district has got to weigh that in terms of what will be the additional cost to a school district, what will be the effect on the instructional program, and how do we balance our budgets? It's a difficult decision.
And then finally, before I get to Representative Holm, the impact on the PERS and TERS issues every school district is facing, has any of the current situation been exacerbated by previous RIF bills that you know of?
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe so. I think the largest contributor was the turn down in the market. That's the largest contribution to the system, and that is the one that we can't seem to recover from. I'm sorry.
Thanks, Representative Holm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Rose, I appreciate you being here because I share with you the same concerns about the brain drain. One of my major concerns, of course, is the fact we've been constantly told for years and years and years and years we don't provide better benefits and higher salaries. We don't attract teachers, administrators to provide a better education for our people in Alaska, our students. I suggest to you that this may cause us some great concern. My wife being a teacher and knowing so many, many teachers over the years, I've seen numerous cases where the teachers who are of the highest qualification are very disturbed with the people that are coming into the system. So if we're going to watch the older teachers go out, the ones that have the history, have the capabilities of handling the classrooms, leave the system to bring in other teachers in there, won't there be a possibility that the education will actually that we're providing be lessened to the students of Alaska rather than enhanced by? And are we trading off? I guess my question could be phrased: are we trading off a better education for our students for saving money?
Representative Holmes, through the chair,
you raise an interesting question, because this is an issue of displacement. If we were to keep the talented teachers at a higher rate, economy suggests you have to reduce in program.
Mr. Rose, I'm going to interrupt. We have to change the tape. We have an equipment problem, so we're just going to change the tape, go off record, pick up where you left off. We want to make sure we get on tape what you say.